Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 71 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
So, announcements this week. I hope you all had a very Merry Christmas, or whatever holiday you celebrate. What do we say? Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa?
You said that.
I did say that. So, I hope everyone had a lovely holiday week. Leading up to this next episode, there was a lot going on again with the Outlander offering,
especially
this. It's been a very special time of the year to be following Outlander, though I will say that most of their new shots, and I use the word new in quotations, are all behind the scenes shots from episodes we've already seen, but I'm still happy to get them. We get to see more of the lovely blue coat worn by Miss Katrina Balf in the first photograph provided by Outlander Stars, with her leaning back on that gorgeous car in the 40s in the town square. Beautiful shot. There'll be one with her looking away from the car, one of her stroking the car lovingly. We also got a shot of Sam Heughan holding a little placard that says Happy Holidays #Outlander. It makes me wonder if that little blank card is blank and they're photoshopping in little
greetings. There have been other things similar to this that, yeah.
I mean, I've seen fans go in and redo that themselves.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think he looks good. Too. Looks real good. I have nothing else to say about that. We also got another shot of Colm in his pixelated socks that will later go back in and give us his twisted Toulouse-Lautrec legs. From what I understand, those socks are to enable them to CGI in the Toulouse-Lautrec-y legs later.
The Toulouse-Lautrec-y, that's a new adjective.
Summer. Somebody had to do it. I did it. And the dude with the camera has a giant belt on. Like, that belt is supporting that camera. Oh my gosh. That is amazing. And that it looks like the buffest camera dude ever. And he looks giant next to Colm. He makes Colm look so tiny. But this is a scene, I believe, from the Gathering? It's either the Gathering or when he does
the punishment thing.
When they're all he's sitting with airing Dougal grievances.
Dougal's next to him. Yeah, this must be the Gathering.
It has to be the Gathering because Dougal would be next to him.
But isn't that at the Gathering?
No, that's the airing of grievances was before the Gathering, right? Yeah. We also got an outlandish offering of, it was the dialect coach from the Outlander set, who was speaking of the different accents used in the series. There are
used throughout Scotland.
Yes.
And her affiliation with the series, from what we understand, is that she would be the accent dialect coach.
Correct. Yeah. But it's so neat. I like that.
I've heard definite differences when I live there. And if you spend any length of time in a place, you'll begin to hear differences, right? And minutiae. So I can tell the difference between East Coast and West Coast, namely Glaswegian and Edinburgh. I can hear those. And I can hear the Highlands, quote-unquote Highlands. But even as she said, Inverness is different than maybe further north, which is different from the further northeast coast. So I definitely, I didn't live too far from Dundee, and I definitely don't remember that Dundee accent, because again, I didn't spend a lot of time there, but I was close-ish too, about an hour away from it. But makes me want to go out to the islands and do my own linguistic survey.
Well, all I know is that on my drive from London to Edinburgh, somewhere between Wales and Edinburgh, we did stop at a Tesco, I believe it was.
Wales is in the opposite direction.
Dude, we were like halfway to, it was like this, whatever road we were on was like between Wales and I was not driving. I'm pretty sure we had a really bad map. Anyway, okay. Somewhere between Wales and Edinburgh, we were stopped and we were asking for directions to get to a specific place. And we were definitely in Scotland. But he was speaking to me, and I could tell it was kind of English, but even I, who am actually pretty good with deciphering, I just had to smile and nod and go back to the car and pull our map out again, because I literally had no idea what he was saying. We also got a Happy Holidays hashtag Outlander starring Miss Katrina Balfe on the 23rd, so 2 days before Christmas. She looks very lovely. She's got her puffy blue coat on, I can tell, and wearing both of her rings and her lovely curly hair. Stars also provided us with a video on the 26th entitled A Day in the Life of Kate, where they kind of had a very short little, like a 48-second video clip, kind of following Katrina through her day. It's very interesting. I'd like to follow her around for a day. As long as it means I get to sit, you know, next to Sam and hang out and play lunch. Scrabble, whatever. Have lunch, Scrabble, whatever they want to do. I'm happy.
I'll just, like, hold her coat. I'd be happy just holding someone's coat or whatever.
I'll hold a boom mic. I can be helpful.
Holding a coat and staying out of the way is probably much safer than holding a boom mic and missing your mark or missing your aim or hitting someone in the head, like Bunny Foo Foo.
Could be fun. And our final Outlander offering was a video of the three leads of the show. So it was Tobias, Sam, and Kate all doing basically a this or that, where they gave them two things to choose between. I thought it was funny. I thought it was funny when they got to Beyonce and Lady Gaga. Everything else was kind of like general life things, and then all of a sudden it was like Beyonce or Lady Gaga.
And didn't they say neither both or of them both?
They said neither. I think she and
Tobias?
I think she and Sam both said neither. But watch it, it's super cute. And lastly, PopSugar.com released an article entitled The 13 Characters Who Made TV a Sexier Place in 2014. And I want to say that I am delighted to announce that number one on their list is Mr. Sam Heughan, which is exactly where he belongs, if you ask me.
On top.
Oh, definitely on top. On.
You led me into that, girl.
I mean, I definitely didn't dissuade you from it. Oh, I guided you there.
I apologize.
And you picked it up. And that's announcements this week. And now, on to our read-along. This is chapter 10 from Dragonfly and Amber, entitled A Lady with Brown Hair Curling Luxuriantly.
Three guesses who that lady might be.
It's me.
Except that you don't have brown hair.
No, I'm wrong. I did. I used to have brown hair.
Well, you do, but just not. Just not these past years.
That's true.
The chapter opens with Claire coming to, or as Connie referred to it, Claire unswoons.
To unswoon.
After she had fainted at the sight of Blackjack Randall. Or was it? Now, I know she only fainted, but seeing this marked difference between Frank and Jamie in voice and timbre and tone when Diana describes the hands, the voices, and everything like that as she's coming to, it was a bit like Claire being on the edge of being in both times, don't you think? Almost like she's not dreaming, she's coming, but she's coming to consciousness, and before she can fully be present in where she physically is, she is...
in both places.
Kind of, yeah. And whenever Diana describes Frank's hands as, Frank's hands were as smooth as a girl's, I understand what she means, that he wasn't like someone going out chopping wood and he wasn't a fighter or that kind of thing. It always makes me giggle, though. Describe a grown man's hands as smooth as a girl's.
You could say smooth as a baby's. Yes. I know plenty of girls who have rough hands.
That is true. So Connie then says about this time, tree alert, is there any significance to the hawthorn blossoms over Jamie's head?
If there is, Ginger will find it.
And I missed it. I was not looking for trees because it was just like these blossoms that appeared over the head. I wasn't thinking of trees at that point. But very good catch. Yes, I looked it up. The hawthorn tree used to be simply known as May, as it represents that month. Of course, Jamie's birthday is May 1st, and the tree is also associated with Beltane or May Day. And according to druidry.org, the young girls rose at dawn to bathe in dew gathered from hawthorn flowers to ensure their beauty in the coming year. For May was the month of courtship and lovemaking after the winter's cold. And so the hawthorn is often found linked with lovemaking. In ancient Greece, the wood was used for the marriage torch, and girls wore hawthorn crowns at weddings. One writer has even gone so far as to suggest that the stale, sweet scent from the trimethylamine of the flowers contain makes them suggestive of sex. But while hawthorn was a propitious tree at Maytime, in other circumstances it was considered unlucky. Witches were supposed to have made their brooms from it, and in some parts it was equated with the abhorred elder. Even today, many people will not allow its branches inside the house, for, as one might expect from its association with Beltane, a time when the two worlds meet, it is considered a tree sacred to the fairies, and thus to be regarded with fear at the least, respect at most. As such, it often stands at the threshold of the other world. Christianity also played its part in preserving the veneration of the hawthorn, because Christ was given a crown of thorns at his crucifixion. The tradition of the tree's magical associations has continued in Christian legend. So yes, Connie, very, very good catch. The image of Jamie with hawthorn blossoms, period. They are associated with fairies, youth, beauty, courtship, marriage, and sex. May, the month of May, the other world, and thus also evil. And they are also tied into Christian legend. We have Jamie's birthday, Beltane, a time when the veils are thin between the two worlds, just as at Samhain. Also, it has associations with marriage, etc. So, Jamie and Claire, who are married. And the other world, Claire caught between two worlds two times. Very symbolic. I don't think trees are ever on accident anymore. I'm too convinced. Every stinking time. So finally, the crown of thorns that Christ received and the hawthorn blossoms appearing, quote, just over Jamie's head. Yeah, there's a little bit there, I think. So Claire, as she's coming to, she's freaking out that Jamie will kill BJR, but of course he didn't, and it ends up, it wasn't BJR. It was a man who looked an awfully lot like him, though, but was about 10 years younger. It's Alexander Randall, Esquire. Then we see the Duke of Sandringham joining the crowd. Quote, the flushed, cherubic countenance of the Duke of Sandringham. He's such a cherub.
Now, what was the last thing we saw the Duke of Sandringham doing? Other than trying to bugger Jamie? It was before the witch trials, right? In the last book? That's the last time we saw him.
It was at the hunt, wasn't it?
Jamie went off with him, and then he was called back
when Jamie was with him on a hunt, right? And then she was taken. She went willingly to go try and help Galus. And while she was just about to burn, Jamie had left. Myrta had gone to go get him, right? Wasn't it Myrta? So. And then Jamie rides back and saves her. Yeah. So that's the last time we had heard of him. Or of him, yeah. Jamie had been with him before Cranesmere. Alexander Randall is all sorts of confuzzled. We learn that he is of holy orders, but employed also as the Duke's secretary.
We also learned that pretty much all Randalls look exactly the same. And I'm wondering...
No matter what, that's a freaking strong gene.
And I'm wondering whether or not they will also employ Tobias Menzies to play this character.
Man, I hope so. All they have to do is, like, make him look a tiny bit younger. He already looks pretty young.
Maybe change the hair color just a little bit. Well, like, obviously the dress would be different.
The hair would be a little bit longer, right? I mean, he probably... Does Alexander wear a wig? I don't even know.
I don't.
But yeah, so Ellen G. writes, so did BJR get Alexander his job with the Duke of Sandringham? This is not answered at this point, and that's a very good question. I had never thought about that.
I don't know if it's ever answered, to be honest.
I don't know if it's ever answered. I mean, is it important? It's an interesting question. If he did get it for him, it would make sense, because we've read this book and we know that whatever Randall may be, he does care for his brother. Is that safe to say?
Oh, mean that, yes.
Alexander.
Absolutely.
So he does care for his brother. So that is something that will not spoil anything. It's just him. Or he cared for him before he was stomped to death.
There are a lot of Alexes.
There's the Alex who hung himself.
Yeah.
With the Bible.
Correct.
There's this Alex.
Correct.
There's Jamie Alex.
Exactly. Which is something that comes up during the Wentworth scene where he was calling Jamie Alex, which makes it a little more uncomfortable now, knowing that he also has a brother named Alex. So there's the dude that hung himself, Alex, in the prison. There's Jamie Alexander Malcolm McKenzie Fraser. And then now there's his brother, Alex, which I'm really hoping that his little cries of torment and love were for the guy who hung himself, because to do that over your own brother is kind of gross.
Yeah.
I mean, we all know he's kind of... He's a sadist, but I never took him for, like...
An incestual sadist?
Yeah.
Huh. So come to think of it, Alexander didn't exactly seem overjoyed to be employed by the Duke. When the Duke makes that comment about the holy orders don't pay well.
Of course they don't.
Well,
unless you're the Pope, and then it pays very, very well.
I just thought it was interesting, was his being, I almost said being buggered. Oh, that was not right. It was him being bugged by the Duke's statement just because the Duke was basically calling him out as someone who was poor and couldn't handle things and needed to work, or basically that this is my charity case, haha. Was he bugged because of the statement, or was he truly upset or bugged, whatever, by the fact that he was right, that he actually couldn't pay his own bills? You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Was he upset that attention was brought to it? I think that would be almost be safe in any case. Or was he more upset that, you know what I'm saying? I guess they're all tied up, but was he more upset that the Duke made a case of it, drew attention to it, or the fact that he has to work for the Duke himself? I don't know. And it makes me think, does he know about the Duke and buggery?
Alex?
Yeah. We don't know yet. I don't know if we ever know. It's kind of, it's a known secret that's not really discussed, you know what I mean? Claire is helped into a sedan chair by two of the king's footmen, and they are to return home and rest so that Madame will be fit enough for the ball the next evening. The king asks permission to dance with her at the ball, and Jamie wasn't keen on the idea, you can tell, but he says that if she is well enough, then surely she'll dance with him. And of course, you don't really tell a king no, so probably would be a big fat yes. They return to Jared's...
You could, but you wouldn't survive long.
Well, they would survive. It's just that. But at least he went to Jamie and asked him and didn't...
It would be detrimental to your welfare to say no to the king in the long run.
They return to Jared's home, and once they have returned to their rooms, Jamie is freaking out now. He says that he was, quote, this close... Well, these are my words. He was this close to murdering Alexander Randall. So thank goodness for the faint.
Like I said last week.
In the nick of time. So what do we know about Alexander Randall? We know that he's BJR's younger brother.
We know that he looks exactly like Frank and BJR.
And that he's a curate of some sort, and that he's employed by the Duke as secretary. Claire says, quote, Frank wasn't particularly interested in him as he wasn't a direct ancestor of his. Not going to say another word. Just let that linger.
But I want you to know that I'm sitting here kind of chuckling to myself and smiling.
We learn that, as we've seen in previous chapters, Jamie still has dreams, though not all that often, of Randall and Wentworth. Diana's description of how Jamie dealt with them, quote, and by the morning, Jack Randall and the other demons of the dark hours had been forced back into their box, battened down and held fast by the steel bands of Jamie's will, and all was well again. So I had a thought about this and Jamie in the box. What's curious about this, and I know it is a way of dealing with it, is his way of dealing with it, but that it's kept in a box, in this imaginary box, right? Or metaphoric box. I have an image of an imaginary box now holding those memories, struggles, experiences, etc. Memories, of course, except for, God forbid, through injury or disease, memories will remain with him. But it's almost like he's not willing or likely not able to deal with the demons to enough of an extent to exorcise them fully. I know it's still a relatively fresh wound, but keeping these things in a box, it's very apt imagery for the fact that he's not rid of them. And stuffing them into a box is a way of dealing with them short term. But as long as the box is there, it's being retained. I just find it interesting. You know, it's a safe place to keep them until he's ready to fully deal and get rid of them. You know what I mean? Having them there, it's like they're always with him. And like I said, the memories will always be with him. That's not what I'm saying. I'm talking about the torture and the big things, the big stuff, the more damaging things of it. Just the other than just memory, the feelings, the torture, the all of that is still with him, and he deals with it. And it works. You know, short term, he has this box. He stuffs him back down. And I just think that it's, Diana writes, and that, quote, all was well again. Well, it was only an artificial well. For to truly be well again, that box, I think the box must be destroyed. You can't destroy the box if you're not ready to deal with what's in the box. You know what I mean? If
you keep saying box, and it makes me think of Pandora's box. Where, like, they release all of the evils out into the world, but what's left in the box? But what's left in the box
is hope.
Is hope. So,
as long as he has the box, he has hope?
I don't know.
I know what you're talking about. I see your link, though.
They're totally different, but boxing things up, bottling things up, never is a good move.
Never works.
I never think it's a good thing.
But it's the short-term remedy.
Though I err on the side of expression, which sometimes also gets me into trouble because I don't like to let things linger, so I just kind of...
She likes to blow them out.
Get him
no
done.
No box here.
Get him done.
It, and then go have a drink.
And then we move on.
So what
and
do
then
you
I don't understand why people are still mad about it 20 minutes later.
So
I let it out.
What do you think, listeners? Do you think Jamie should keep his box? Someone don't laugh at me. Do you think that, do you agree that it's a somewhat temporary way, a short-term whatever way for him to deal with this trauma, which is understandably major? Memories will not leave him, but do you think, do you agree, do you disagree? What do you think?
I think that, well, personally, boxes don't work for me. I think that...
She destroys the boxes.
I do. I think that to each his own, and everyone mm-hmm. needs to deal with trauma in different ways.
Absolutely.
And some people need to hold on to something and process it privately.
And look at it a little by little. Yeah.
Process it in their own way, and then once they've done that, in their own time and fashion, can move forward. But there's mm-hmm. no expiration or timeline on grief, on pain, on trauma. So
yeah, and you know what? What she didn't say, and this is me making a total, not even an assumption, I'm just making a guess. So he stuffs them back in the box to, and he's safe, all is well again for a period of time, right? What we don't know is if every time he stuffs them back, if it's a little bit less than the last time. You know? Because mm-hmm. if that keeps happening, that is a way of dealing with it. And at some point, if it's less and less each time, even if it's minute, there will come a time when you can open the box and say, it no longer causes me to shiver naked in windows.
It's true, but the problem with boxes, bottles, and any other kind of method of confinement mm-hmm. is that they are finite. And eventually, you will reach capacity, and the only thing that happens
so you're
from
saying
then
it's
is
not getting, it's not unless it gets less and less being put away.
Correct. Unless
the box can
unless,
be finite, but you're putting less away, so
right.
it won't get filled.
Unless you're venting it in little bits to kind of ease the pressure involved mm-hmm. in what you've been stuffing into there. A lot of times, you don't have enough space within that
container.
Method or container to contain all of that awfulness. And let's be totally like honest about this. There's a lot of crap that happens in this time period. That's mm-hmm. that's it's just compiling. I don't know that he has enough room in that box.
What do you think, listeners? What is Jamie's box like to you?
Dirty.
No, I'm not trying to be dirty. I'm curious what they think. So as Claire falls asleep, she is seeing Frank's face. It is of Frank that she dreams. Frank is lecturing and has some realia with him, objects of vertu, a silver candlestick, a French counter box, and we'll share some links that Connie provided about from some examples of the counter box. A white clay pipe, an English gold-mounted scent bottle, a gilt bronze inkstand, a cracked horn spoon, a small marble clock, and some painted miniatures, all from the collections of the British Museum. Connie makes a very good point. So when did Claire ever observe Frank giving such a lecture? He hadn't yet started at Oxford when she went through the stones in the 1700s. Maybe he did teach a bit before the war broke out? She says, we are presented with a conundrum. Are these images of Frank based on Claire's actual experience or wholly invented in her mind?
I personally think that there's a touch of the supernatural in Claire.
I'm thinking so too.
It's definitely touched upon in several of the books in the series. And my impression is that this is a mix. And most people talk about it. If you have prophetic dreams, they're usually a mixture of like the prophecy part of it mixed with a little bit of like surrealism. So to me, this was like a mixture of something that perhaps actually happens, and perhaps also her mixing it a bit with the things that are going on in her life. So I think there's the yearning for her, for Frank, that happens in this dream, as well as maybe a little bit of her actually seeing this happen. Like, this was something he would actually do. Now, do I think he actually came across a picture of her and would have, or a picture of Jamie and would have lectured on it? Probably not. That would be so coincidental as to be unbelievable. But I think that that's that level of surrealism added in with this prophetic dream to make it more personal for her.
Well, Connie writes, perhaps at some point in the time after Claire met Frank, she observed him giving a history lecture. It is unclear from the dream memories whether Claire was a student or perhaps dropped in on Frank's lectures after they were married. Also, other than the setting being in England, we don't know where the lecture took place. Frank had not yet taken up his new post at Oxford at the time Claire disappeared. But what can we learn about Frank from this dream memory? Or for that matter, what can we learn about Claire? Frank shows skill in getting and holding the attention of his students, both male and female, with his hand gestures, jokes, and eye contact. Frank's lecture technique involves making eye contact with his students, first one, then another, even eliciting flirtatious responses from some of the females. Does this tell us more about how charming Frank must have been, more than we observed in Outlander? And about those hand gestures, look at the many and varied ways Diana describes Frank using his hands as he describes out how everyday objects are useful in understanding people, how people lived. Observe how delicately, yet inexorably and seductively, Diana draws our attention to Frank's hands. Smooth, not hairy, as compared with Alex Randall's, we heard described right at the beginning of the chapter. Connie outlined many examples that Diana used to bring our attention to Frank's hands. Finally, she shares, if the dream is truly evidence of her relationship with Frank, we can sympathize with the loss of a man with a slow hand. And that makes me think of that song.
Yeah, it just went through my head when you said that.
I want a man with a slow hand. And that's it. So Frank lectures...
I want a lover with an easy touch.
No more. Frank lectures of the people of history, how we know so little of them, writings of a few, objects which show us a little of how they lived. Frank says, these are pretty things after all. Remember that line from episode 106 when Randall says to Claire, it's a pretty thought?
Always.
Or something to that effect? Whew, geez, to hear those words from Frank's lips, not related to season one, is just very interesting to read that or think about that. So as he discusses the various objects, or lack of types of objects, and what they can tell us about people of a certain time, he inhales from the scent bottle and tells the class that it is L'Heure Bleue.
Of course he did.
His favorite.
Of course it is. But he never mentions, my wife used to wear those.
He then looks at the small miniatures, how the subjects themselves are often unknown and look similar, but now and again one stands out. He holds up a miniature of Jamie. Of them, he says, they were real people. They did much the same things you do. They cared about their children. They loved their husbands or wives. Well, sometimes they did.
Ouch.
Hoocha hoocha. Then he holds up a miniature, a lady, with brown hair curling luxuriantly to her shoulders and a necklace of pearls, undated, the artist unknown. Claire sees this and considers it a mirror, not a miniature. She describes how Frank, quote, gently traced the edge of her jaw, the graceful line of her neck. Frank goes on, undated, unknown, but once she was real. I hope they keep this scene because it is very powerful and there's so much they could do with it. And, you know, showing him not only his style, right, his lecture style, the images, the miniatures of Jamie and Claire, the objects, and also his lecture style and him kind of being a little bit flirtatious with the students. I think there's so much in that that can be conveyed that people can jump on or not.
It's true. But here's the reason I think it would be nice and / important to keep in this, because he has such a small part in season two, mm-hmm. Frank does, that this would be good.
You mean Tobias Menzies?
No.
Oh, just Frank?
Yeah, just Frank.
Oh, sorry. We're not getting ahead of ourselves. Sorry.
But he does come back in season three, and in season three, there is more things that would be kind of inferred by this. Like, a lot of this stuff is kind of foreshadowing for his, how he is.
And not just season three. I mean, even if he doesn't come back.
I'm just speaking of the character. Like, the character of Frank. When Frank comes back in season three, it's a whole new Frank. And this, it's a lot of more like this Frank, actually.
Yes, but even Frank that's referred to in later books.
Oh, yeah.
This stuff could come back. You just don't know.
Of course it could. I'm just saying this is a good...
It's a good thing to put in there for a scene setting.
Correct.
Character setting. Correct. Character, yeah, preparation.
It would make season three a little less of a jarring thing to have this happen.
Ellen G. writes, Jamie didn't have problems sleeping like he usually did when under the influence of BJR memories. Then it's like a time change, and Claire is listening to Frank's lecture about objects of vertu, which, by the way, happen to have portraits of Jamie and Claire. But it's also interesting to see how much Frank is flirting with his class, commenting about Miss Smith taking too many notes, or having a plump blonde girl smell fragrance in an old perfume bottle. Claire starts to cry and comes awake. Jamie consoles her. Diana's description of her coming to herself, again, remember the first time she comes to herself is at the beginning of the chapter. She's coming out of a faint. Quote, the small night sounds of the Paris house came slowly to my ears, bringing me back to the life that was mine. That's a Lotus statement too. Not just bringing me back to consciousness, bringing me back to the life that was mine.
The life that she chose.
Yes. The life that she chose, the life that is now hers, as opposed to what was hers and what could have been hers. And so that's like a little shiver, to me, a little shiver-worthy line.
No, but like this dream that she had went from being just kind of a pleasant, kind of a dream, a remembrance dream, or a thought of someone she used to
being
know
caressed
dream.
By her
No,
first husband.
To being horrific. She's being suffocated in this mirror. Like that, but, like him looking at a picture that was actually her, like feeling like she was being stuck in this, like that was like suffocating. That to me feels like the dreams where you wake up when you're somewhere between awake and asleep and you can't move.
The old hag.
No.
You ever heard of that?
No.
I'm not going to Google it right now. You never heard? Did that come out randomly?
Yes.
There is something I've heard on. I used to listen to a lot of late night driving. Apparently, I used to listen to a lot of Art Bell. And Coast to Coast with Art Bell. And people would call in and talk about, you know, there'd be different subjects on different shows, but they would call in and have like an open line or whatever and talk about things that scared them or things that happened to them, experiences they had had. A lot of them are pretty like, wah, wah, woo, woo, right? But one of the common things, and you can look it up, it is kind of a legend or a phenomenon, whatever, called the old hag. It's supposedly, some people have visions, some people don't. But when you wake up in between sleeping and waking or whatever, and you can't move, it's like a little bit of sleep paralysis, and you can't move, but you're conscious of something, that's called the old hag syndrome. Because at this point, some people who have this feeling are on their backs, and they look up, and there's a figure of an old woman, like literally sitting over them or on top of them.
For the record.
Is that freaking you out?
You're freaking me out.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, because I never, ever see an old lady sitting on me. However, now, every time this happens, I'm going to envision an old lady sitting on me and
like
making me.
Like an old witch, not just like.
Making me unable to move.
Not just like our dearly departed grandmother. Not like that kind
she
of
She would
lady.
Never do that. She was awesome. I'm just saying.
Like an old witch hag.
No, that's I understand what you're saying. My point is that usually when I can't move, I also can't open my eyes. It's part of the paralysis thing. So maybe I'll try to more actively open my eyes and then maybe.
So you can see the hag?
So I can see the hag sitting on my chest keeping
me
unable to
move. Okay, we're not art to art with Coast Bell. Oh, Lord have mercy. We're not coast to coast and we're not a radio show like that.
We are coast to coast. We're actually international. Let's put that out there.
We're not coast to coast though. He's international too. But anyway, we're not that show.
No.
And we're not a call-in show. But if you guys have had any experiences with the old hag, that would be interesting to hear. What do you guys think? Is this something that, at least, have you heard of the phenomenon?
I'm sure you all have experienced the phenomenon. I've just never heard of it being called the old hag.
Okay, well, now you have, and maybe you can go read up on it, or maybe you don't want to read up
on
it.
I mean, it was terrifying enough before you told me an old lady was sitting on my chest and wishing me ill.
I don't know about the wishing you ill part, but definitely scary.
No, the worst, because you're usually, like, laying there, you can't move, and you hear something going on that you need to go and fix, and you can't get up to do it.
Yeah.
Or usually there's, like, somebody in the room, or there's something going on, and you know you need to go help some. There's no old hag. Now there is, but there was never an old hag before. Usually, for me, it was like there was some sort of distress, you know, something in the room that I needed to attend to that I could not physically get up and fix. That was the fear, was that I couldn't, or maybe there was somebody breaking in and I couldn't stop them. It was something keeping me from it, but I never thought of an old lady, and now, thank you, I will think that there's an old lady trying to keep me from moving.
Do you know what the old hag reminds me of? Although it's not, I mean, you can't ask an infant, baby, what do you feel or what do you see? But the fact that she's supposedly on you or on your chest or on your stomach or somewhere on you, somehow on you, reminds me of that little, That little thing in the movie that I cannot watch anymore, Cat's Eye, little gremlin, whatever, that comes, the troll, the nasty little beast that comes through the walls. The
wall thing, yeah.
And he comes and the cat like actually protects the baby. Yeah. Yeah, a little bit. That's just, I can't watch that. Ellen G. points out, and to find out this was Claire's dream. So she reacted to meeting Alexander and not Jamie. It was very interesting kind of turnaround there. Connie also notes that it was Claire's dream and not Jamie's. Claire does not normally have... She's dreamed of Frank before, right? But I'm sure... But we've usually in this book, at least, not so much in... Well, late Outlander.
In Outlander, she didn't really talk about dreams at all. It was really more of the day-to-day of her new reality.
Well, I know that, but I mean, as far as having terror dreams or really dreams that really affected someone, it was late Outlander, right? Toward the end of Outlander, when we get Jamie's.
Yeah.
And then here, hers. And then, of course, Jamie's earlier in this book.
Right.
So it's an interesting, we don't get a lot of hers.
These two characters have been traumatized by this point in the series that they're both prone to having trauma dreams. So that's all I have to say about that.
And as she wakens with tears, Jamie says he can't grudge Frank her dreams nor her tears, and that if the need should come, that she might mourn him that way, gives him some comfort. She seems to want to reassure him that she won't return to Frank or to her time. Jamie says, "No, we are bound, you and I, and nothing on this earth shall part me from you." And he reminds her of their blood vow. He says, "Blood of my blood and bone of my bone, you carry me within ye, Claire, and ye canna leave me now, no matter what happens. You are mine always, if you will it or no, if you want me or nay, mine, and I will na let ye go." The chapter ends with his words, "For I give ye my spirit till our life shall be done."
The echo back to the blood vow. This isn't the last time we'll have heard of the blood vow. It's not the first time we heard of the blood vow. In fact, the blood vow comes up several times in the series. It's like a, hey, in case you've forgotten.
Don't forget. Yeah.
Don't forget. So that is chapter 10 of our read-along.
And this is also our last episode of 2014, Summer.
Good grief. How did that happen?
I have no idea. I remember thinking just before New Year's or whatever, of 2013, mm-hmm. being so excited. We didn't have, you know, we didn't know what 2014 would bring, obviously.
I mean, we knew it was going to bring Outlander.
Well, we knew it would bring Outlander. We didn't know when, but we knew it would be there sometime. And we knew by December, by the time we were doing our last episode of 2013, we did know about the January 11th fan event because those were, I remember, because we were at a dinner for a family member on December 11th of 2013, and which is when we heard about it. So I know the date. Mm-hmm. That's how I remember. So by late December, obviously, we knew about January 11th because it was a month, the day. So we had that to look forward to just after the new year, and then, of course, production continuing after the break, and then, of course, sometime in the summer or fall, we didn't know when, Outlander would be coming up. And now, as we sit at the end of 2014, looking like on the precipice, looking over in towards 2015, but not quite there yet, and looking back at all of 2014, what are some of your highlights?
The highlights of 2014.
For you, yeah.
Definitely being on the tartan carpet. That at the premiere and being completely tongue-tied.
And having Ginger squeeze your crotch.
Dude, y'all, I don't even want to talk about it. But
totally.
What struck me more is that I held it together while it happened because I didn't want to impact the Tobias interview. However, for me personally, that was not as big of a thing as it was for you, apparently. But for me, was...
Oh, wait, the
you
crotch?
You keep mentioning it.
No, I just think it's funny.
It is funny. But for me, it was standing with Kate and Sam, like, 3 inches away from my face and having them stare at me while I try and think of a coherent thing to say. Mm-hmm. So that was a big thing for me. Being a part of that premiere audience was big. It was huge.
Was nice. They're completely different events, but of course, the premiere event was just all around fun. But I had a ball. I was very fortunate to, you know, to get to go into Comic-Con, to get to go to Diana's event here locally, as well as in Seattle. And as you will read and you will hear countless Outlander fans say, one of the best things besides, you know, for selfish reasons, and I think everyone will admit this, for selfish reasons for all of us, we get our story. We get our Jamie and Claire. That's like the biggest thing and the best thing of all. But the fact that it's done by a company and by people who are so dedicated and into the story, you know, yes, it's a financial thing. If it doesn't make money, if it's not successful, it won't continue. I get it. But outside of that, which has to be with every production, and they have to keep those things in mind, this is, it's been incredible to see how caring the producers and the actors, everybody involved, coaches, everything like that, have been, and how willing they are to speak with fans and to involve fans at certain levels. And I don't, maybe because it was the first, I don't say big thing, but the first thing that you and I did that we were ever to be part of, even, not even the podcast, just as fans, that January 11th event was, it was something else.
Yeah, that was electric.
It was pretty nice.
But what I will say is that speaking for Ginger myself, I really shouldn't speak for her, but the main thing that I've gotten from this year is that find your passion. And if you find your passion and you just do it, good things do follow and come to pass because of it. There are so many things that we have been able to do because we have
asked,
put it out there.
Or made the intention.
Just put it out in the universe.
Put it out there and plan for it. And act as if. Plan for something. You know, if something doesn't work, you're no worse off for having tried.
And that's a life lesson, honestly. So put it out there. And if they say no, you're no worse off than you were before.
All that can happen is the planning that you make doesn't work out. And what? You're just doing the same thing you would do anyway. Right. So yeah. So I will say one thing that we did, you know, no details, but there were a few things. If you guys have ever heard, and this is not trying to get woo-woo, you can talk about it. You can make it woo-woo, but you can do it with any...
Is that a technical term, woo-woo? Woo-woo,
kind of.
Okay.
You can do it with any religious belief, with any background or lack thereof. But something that Summer and I did was, it wasn't exactly a vision board, but it was a kind of an intention. We have a cork board in our office. Anyway, and we kind of brainstormed at the beginning of the year, actually late 2012, I think. We brainstormed and thought about things and you know, kind of cleared our calendars a little bit in case certain things worked out. But we would just put post-it notes up or an email up or something and just concentrate on that. Not everything comes to fruition, but gosh darn it, so many things did. It's just kind of crazy. So yes, you know, don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't be afraid to
ask for what you want.
Make opportunities for yourself.
Oh yeah. But I think that's a good lead in to our New Year's resolutions.
Which is?
I think that our pod New Year's resolution is to attempt.
To put it out there?
We're going to put it out there. I'm putting this out there that we would like to sometime in the very near future take Pod to the motherland. And by the motherland, I mean Scotland. So we're putting that out there.
With intent.
That we would like to do that. So may you all join us on this journey that we hopefully...
And if it's your dream to go somewhere or do something, put it out there, make the intent, and start planning for something. And again, if it doesn't work out, maybe it will the following year, but you're no worse off for having tried at this point. I think that's a little wrap up for our for our year.
Yes, but there you cannot wrap up any year leading into a new year without a very familiar song that was written by Robert Burns. I'm sure you've all heard it. Most people sing it at almost every New Year's Eve gathering you've ever been to.
No matter where you are in the world.
Seriously, doesn't matter. Even if you're in Well, I can't say that. I've never been to the Middle East. They may not sing it there.
Well, that's true. They probably...
But they do sing it in most English-speaking countries. Regardless, it's a well-known Scottish song that you may not have known was Scottish, or that you may not have known was written by Robert Burns. But that being said, we have decided to bring back...
My Bonnie to me.
No. So as a way to commemorate the end of 2014, leading into the beginning of 2015, we have decided to once again make you all listen to us sing.
that's very foreboding, or
it could be. Have you listened to it yet?
Forceful. I have. it is what it is.
But I will say that I have been teaching myself how to play the ukulele for a couple of years now, and I am still very novice, but we decided this year to take it up a notch from our a cappella silent night last year by including a little bit of ukulele music into this year's rendition of Robert Burns's Auld Lang Syne.
Should old acquaintance
Summer and I, from the Outlander podcast, wish Outlander fans everywhere all the best for 2015. Have a happy, happy Hogmanay. See you on the other side.
Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/OutlanderPod or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.
I dreamt it last night that my young